Thanks for listening to Other People's Flowers. If you'd like to have your work featured on the program, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
All this week's work is by Patricia Lawler Kennett. Patricia is a semi-retired lawyer and entrepreneur. Her work has appeared in Slate.com, The Fiction Pool, and Mother magazine. A Fall from Grace. I am well girded in a tight velvet skirt. Shimmery light support stockings and a vest of black beads. My chignon pulls like a temporary facelift, and I am at ease. I feel like I can talk to anyone. The scene is cinematic, a sweeping view of the East River from inside the penthouse of a well-known plastic surgeon. In the corner, a celebrated right-wing radio talk show host fingers a bowl of cashews. I'm an early arrival, and there is plenty of space to move about. I haven't had a thing to drink. And yet it happens. A sturdy woman holding a silver tray of drinks stops in front of me. "Would you care for a beverage?" she asks, barely above a whisper. As I reach for a bottle of sparkling water, I sense the woman drooping and tilting like a prop jet out of gas, trying to steady the accident about to unfold. With a sudden surge of horror, I realise I have managed to knock every glass off the tray. They crash and break on the hardwood floor like a loose sack of diamonds. And the decanter of Merlot, I hadn't even noticed, runs onto a keelim. A river of red floods the intricate weave. Did I turn too fast, not look, become distracted, not care? The tanned host pretends not to notice, but I know he sees me. The clumsy one. The woman serving the drink says, "I'm sorry," and starts to sop the rug. But we both know it was my fault. It's her job to take the heat. I apologise, but it hardly matters. Dropping things, tripping over curbs, walking into walls, a lady keystone cop, awkward, ungainly, bungling, maladroit, butterfingers. Some of us float, while others flounder. On the one hand, there's Audrey Hepburn, Grace Kelly, and Kate Windsor. On the other wobbly hand, there are others like Carol Burnett and Lucille Ball who understood the charm, dare I say, sex appeal of a well-timed pratfall. After all, who can forget the episode of Sex in the City when Carrie Manilow made a misstep while she tried to glide down a runway and her body collapsed like a rag doll in an oil slick? I related to her mix of humiliation and resignation. Suffice to say that falling while in an altered state of chemical consciousness does not apply. I pride myself on being a natural klutz. But does being graceful matter really these days? How important is it to stand tall, sit like a lady, never stumble, knock over a pitcher or pulverise a piece of waterford? For some women, being graceful means being assured and in control. Whether they're totally soused or sober is Judge Judy. Rolling on the high seas or passing out canapes. Some ladies never lose their footing. It's that essential. For others, like me, being graceful is a pseudo-virtual, a throwback, another quality that females must develop lest they feel inadequate. I can't quite make up my mind about the importance of gracefulness. It ranks, for me, somewhere between hygiene and courage. It's subtler than good manners and, in my opinion, not teachable like rules of etiquette. My parents, both well-intentioned but oblivious, never seemed to notice or care that their youngest daughter lacked an essential social grace. I should have gone to charm school and learned the secrets that those other girls appeared to possess in their book-balancing heads. We had one institution in our blue-collar neighbourhood, the mainline school of grace and charm. An orange stucco building in the middle of Moyamensing Avenue in South Philadelphia. Its name, appropriated from the Blue Blood suburb to the west, belied an irony difficult to overlook since this particular establishment abutted a tyre store and a vegetable stand. I often wondered what went on inside there, but pretended not to care as I sped by the place on my sparkly banana seat bike. Instead of charm school, my interest leaned toward reading Kurt Vonnegut, playing Pinocchio, and leading seances. In those days, a girl either worried about the way she walked or worked on her brain. As I recall, most of the mainline school graduates looked great at the prom, married the tyre rotator, but never moved out of the neighbourhood. Despite this, part of me wishes I had gone for at least one session. Now it's too late. The cocktail party is just one in a string of incidents in my never-ending fall from grace. It began right on the cusp of puberty, a protracted camping trip with my aunt Anne-Marie and her marine husband, Bill. Far from civilization and inappropriately shod with PF flyers for the rough terrain of the Blue Mountains of West Virginia, I tripped over every rock and mound of dirt on every hike we took that long weekend. God damn it, my grizzly uncle declared in his drill sergeant voice, that girl can't walk and swallow a spit at the same time. Flash forward to the late 1970s. I'm ready for action in a navy polyester zipper jumpsuit. I sashay past the man that I met the week before in this noisy disco, hoping he'll notice me and my pyramid perm. His collar is long and pointing and his eyes are on me. But the challenge of my platforms defeats the required elegance of this mating ritual. I miss a step, then another, and I'm down for the count. Desperate for a quick recovery, I maintain a brave smile, but the moment is gone. He's looking for a girl who can hustle, spin, swirl, and still land on her feet. That's not me. Years later, and another man notices. He proposes an intimate Italian dinner for our first date. We discuss current events on the way to the restaurant while he drives. I'm thrilled to get the chance to enchant him, without having to move. He likes what I'm saying. I'm shining here. My brain is the most graceful part of my anatomy. The words and turns of phrases ebb and flow seamlessly. We sit at the table. I'm in a pink silk suit and white blouse. Bread is served, then spaghetti. I'm taking him in, giving up a few secrets, boasting, provoking, flattering. I can strut my stuff as long as I don't have to walk. As I wrap the spaghetti around my fork, the sauce breaks free from the pasta and lands on my blouse like a bullet wound. He points with a tentative smile and offers a wet napkin. The water soaks through and the fabric sticks to my skin. For a moment, I wonder whether the damp rail might remind him of Jacqueline Bisset, dripping and sultry in the deep. No, not really. He smiles, follows up with a dry napkin and asks me to finish my thought. Never mind the stubborn stain. A few dates after that, at a quiet sushi bar, the glass of water I just knocked over dribbles towards his side of the table and darkens the leg of his pressed khakis. Still, again, he's unperturbed and more interested in what I'm saying than the faux pas. In that moment, I knew we were going to work. On my wedding day, I reluctantly opt for sensible satin shoes and manage to walk down the aisle without incident. 19 years and 2 children later, with dozens of lacy cuffs drenched in salad dressing, heels caught in Subway grates, a roasted chicken careening across the kitchen floor, vases and china smashed and mirrors threatening 21 years of bad luck. He still hovers closer as I approach the 6-foot drop of an open cellar door on a Manhattan sidewalk. He's been anointed the graceful one in the family. Light as a deer on his feet, nary a scuff on his 2-year-old shoes. The better dancer, hands down. To my utter relief and slight astonishment, our daughter is possessed of his delicate, steady nature. Still, as she rounds the bend into her teenage years, when centres of gravity shift and distractions, electronic and hormonal, conspire to compromise her balance, I stand by, hoping to catch her if she slips. More important than breaking her fall, I want her to learn from me that there are more ways than one to show the world you're a stand-up gal. I want her to know that if she ever finds herself in a Shiraz-drenched cocktail dress or with a run in her Wolfords from an unintended tumble, her wit will prop her up. And if she's lucky, like me, she'll find a man like her father who thinks she walks on water. Remarkable Pig. Eliza stayed up after her parents went to bed. The house was quiet and dark. She tucked her legs under an orange knitted caftan and she settled down with a bag of Wise potato chips and a Pepsi Light to watch late night television. A restless carpet of blue sea and then the prow of a ship heaving over the waves filled the TV screen. Then he appeared, sneering. For 2 hours, Eliza didn't move as she watched Marlon Brando portraying Christian Fletcher. Was it the neat bowed ponytail, the tight tanned breeches, or his haughty arrogance as he planned for the takeover against the evil Captain Bligh? Was it him lying next to that dark-haired Tahitian woman on the tilted mound of sand? Was it him spitting out the words of perverse mercy to Captain Bligh? you remarkable pig. You can thank whatever pig god you prayed to that you haven't turned me into a murderer. Potato chips, crumbs, sprinkled over Eliza's blanket. Her saliva pooled in the space under her tongue. Eliza would be beautiful and witty around Marlon Brando if he just gave her the chance. Eliza had heard somewhere that Marlon Brando had actually fallen in love with the Tahitian actress, Mimet, in the film, and he'd gotten her pregnant. Had gotten her pregnant. I would like to meet Marlon Brando. He would like me. How old is he? Wouldn't it be nice if we could meet sometime? I want to meet him. Just to talk. But it can't be Marlon Brando right now, so instead it's John from Mildred Street. John is 20 and Eliza is 13. It feels better to call him a guy instead of her man. Her friend's father's a man. Marlon Brando is a man. As Eliza is walking to school in early June, just a few days before the end of 8th grade, the light is as yellow and soft as butter. She's daydreaming. School's almost over. High school next year. She stops to yank up her knee socks near the corner of the field. Remember me? Remember me? He wears aviator-shaped eyeglasses that get darker in the sun. There are splatters of white paint on his hands and nails. He is a house painter. Eliza had met him a few nights before on the corner of 7th and Johnston. He was with her cousin Denise, standing on the corner with a couple of other girls and guys doing their best to look good doing nothing. She was wearing a patchwork Madras shirt and low-rise jeans. Her dirty blonde hair as well is parted down the middle, flat and unflattering, with a bell-shaped wave right at the bottom. Denise and Eliza were out of their vector, which is 11th Street, Oregon to Bigler. The corner of 7th and Johnston is rougher. The houses are run down. As Denise and Eliza left the house, Eliza's mother warned, "A lot of coloureds live round there. You better be careful." Denise, suited in her corduroy jean jacket, smiles and shakes her long brown hair. "Don't worry, Aunt Katie. We'll be careful." John was sitting in his parked car, a light green Rambler station wagon, with the passenger door held together by a rope. Denise handed Eliza a bag of sunflower seeds. She took a handful and split the seeds in half with her teeth and spit the shell on the ground. Somebody started to pass around a joint. John was taking turns with the joint and a Marlboro. The street lamp cut a triangle of light on the corner, like a stage. There was a boy with blonde hair and round wire glasses. A girl in tight white pants and puckered halter and thick black hair started to laugh and couldn't seem to stop. Denise sucked on the joint and passed it on. John's giggling, the pot smelled like licorice, and even Eliza started to feel a little high from just standing in its cloud. He saw Eliza look in his direction. She was standing 2 feet away from his open car window. "Do you live round here?" he asks. He is slouched low in his seat. Eliza leans over to answer. "No, I live on 11th Street. I don't even know anybody here except my cousin Denise. I'm John. Now you know me," he said. He exhaled. "What's your name?" "Eliza." "Eliza. Eliza. That's a pretty name." "Do people call you Liz?" "No, nobody calls me Liz. I hate Liz. Lizzie too." John smiled. "Okay, Eliza." An ember fell from the joint and landed on John's pant leg. "Shit," he yelled, beating the spark. He ripped open the car door and jumped out. "Holy shit, I got a hole in my pants." He leaned against the side of his car and smiled at Eliza. "What an ass I am, huh?" "It was an accident," Eliza said. "The hole's not too big. You have that stuff. Now you can put a piece of fabric and iron on it, and with a little plastic goo, and the hole disappears." "What's your name again?" They talked some more, and he asked her for her phone number. He asked if she wanted a ride home. "No," she keeps saying, because she likes the way her nose make him ask again. "So where do you go to school?" "Stella Maris." "What grade?" 8th. "I'm graduating soon." With the little bit of information she provided that night, John figures out how to find her this morning. He pops out of the corner. "Remember me?" "Yeah, I met you a few nights ago. Here's a flower." He hands her a daisy, and she takes it. "How do you know where I go to school? How do you know I would be going to school now?" She sounds flattered, and her soft tone seems to fall on his ear like a petal. He takes a step closer. He's not much to look at in the unforgiving sunshine. Her hair is barely brushed. She's wearing a short-sleeve uniform blouse. Her skin is white and her hands are soft and plump. Scuffed shoes, baggy socks. He leans against a short chain-length fence. Behind it, a black and white dog scampers. You told me, don't you remember? She does remember, but she didn't expect to see him. He was so high. I'm on my way to work. Can I walk you to school? Okay. Yes. This is the yes that sets the wheels in motion. Walk me to school. Sit on my step. Buy me a little opal ring. Write me a poem. Pet my dog. Tell me that my eyes are three different colours. Pick me up in your car. Tell me about your father, the one who let you down. Introduce me to your mother, the one you still live with. Tell me your dreams. Tell me that I'm your dream. Pick me up at the corner, she tells him a few weeks later on the telephone. She leaves her house with a vague explanation to her mother about where she's going. She doesn't want them to tell her no because she is saying yes. If they don't see him, she can be vague about who he is. He smokes a lot of pot, which he offers and she refuses. They spend most weekends together over the summer before high school begins. On a cool Friday night, they buy cherry vanilla ice cream cones at Delio's on 10th and Oregon. Afterwards, they go down to his basement where there's a yellow beach chaise longue and a line of laundry hanging near the washing machine. She sits on the lounge chair. He puts on a Frank Zappa album. His mother is at bingo. What's the ugliest part of your body? I think it's your mind. She hears the words, but they sound far away, and she feels far away. John sits at her feet, singing along, and then moves his hand up the side of her leg. He keeps his head down, not looking at her. Eliza looks at his hand as it creeps along and then turns her face up to the ceiling. He reaches for the zipper of her pants, and she shifts her body to make it easier for him. His hands brace her hips, and he kisses her belly. Then lower down until he's right there. She touches the top of his head, soft brown hair. She doesn't want him to stop. Stop. There is no way to stop. Now she's begging, but she's not sure if it's to stop or keep going. There is his white t-shirt hanging on the line. He moves her hand towards his stiffened crotch. She knows this is wrong. It's a sin that would be too embarrassing to confess to Father Carboni. And therefore it's a sin that will never be forgiven. Can she just ask the Virgin Mary to help her resist these temptations and deliver her from evil? Amen, amen, amen. When it's over, she promises herself to be better, to do better. This won't happen again. On Sunday, she goes to church but doesn't take communion. As Eliza walks down the grey granite steps from the church, John is waiting for her. How does he know where she is all the time? Do you know you have a glow? Every time I see you walk out of church, you seem to be lit up. It's amazing. He is smiling, his brown eyes are moist. She's not glowing inside, she's not innocent, she can't be now. But she wants him to notice her, and tell her that she is beautiful. She wants to prove to him that she likes him. She doesn't want to hurt his feelings. She knows what it takes to make him happy. Just to be good and sweet and go to church and then go to his basement. She wants to get out of her house, even if it's to his basement. If he's too old for her, it's just because she doesn't like boys her own age. John drives Eliza home from church in his station wagon, filled with paint cans, drop cloths and brushes. When they get to 11th Street, her mother is on the porch sweeping. He parks the car. Hello, I'm John Averson, he says to Eliza's mother. She leans against the handle of her broom. Where are you from? The neighbourhood over there on Mildred Street. She says, and starts sweeping again. He's wearing black pants and an alligator belt with a red striped shirt. He's freshly shaven. Where do you work? She asks. All over. I'm a house painter with my father. That's nice. She leans the broom against the porch railing. Want to come in for breakfast? John and Eliza continue to date through the fall. He takes her to jazz clubs and art films. He takes her to French restaurants with food so rich that she excuses herself and vomits between courses. When his mother's not home or asleep, they go to his bedroom and mess around. Not all the way, just mess around, just short of all the way. She can keep him happy now and hold him off at the same time. She still thinks of Marlon Brando, still wishes there was a way they could meet. She wishes she could rewind her nights with John and stay in her house and watch movies and stay away from John's desire and her own. She deplores herself for wanting his mouth on her, hers on his. There must be a way out of this endless loop of lust, satisfaction, humiliation. Eliza wishes someone could explain it to her. There's only silence and self-reproach. There's no sense that perhaps John is no match for her. She let the floodgates open with Marlon Brando. She is shipwrecked. Lost at sea. A remarkable pig. Weighted with irons. Jay's shower. Bethany farted in the shower. This would have been of little consequence in her memory had it not been followed by a Jenga tower of incidents that complicated her already unstable world. In other words, who specifically remembers not just a shower fart, but one that both distance in time and non-singular in execution unless one thing leads to another because of it? Like many farts, it smelled bad. Again, this matters little except for the fact that the area was enclosed and Jay was about to step into the shower with her. For some couples, this would have resulted in nothing but a giggle, a disgusted wave of the hand, or a PU issue resolved. Bodily function noted. But they weren't that kind of couple. They never would be. The communal showering was brand new, a big step for both of them. Their intimacy was still in its infancy, and they had, up until now, chosen to express it in a fairly buttoned-up fashion. Jay was a reserved individual, lanky, blue-eyed, receding. Jay possessed the physical marks of his WASP heritage, along with the slightly effete mannerisms of many bluebloods. He leaned forward, crossed his legs, and bent his wrists in an animated fashion when he spoke about something that excited him, like beveled edging, the Second Amendment, or his old wolfy dog. He read novels, one of few men she had ever met who did that. He ate tomato and mayonnaise white bread sandwiches over the kitchen sink and never offered Bethany a bite. She wasn't put off, the things he ate didn't even seem like food to her. She was used to family dinners with piles of drenched manicotti, pork in red gravy and butter cookies. On her own, she sufficed with a Kit Kat and a Diet Coke. Jay was a local boyfriend, the long game one miles away. So Bethany settled into a cycle of self-recrimination and mild hypomania whenever she and Jay got together. Bethany always made sure Jay knew he was a third party. She felt like she was playing house in a minefield. When Jay once wondered out loud what she saw in him, Bethany said, "You're my Atticus Finch. You're the calm in the storm. And I don't know anybody like you." Jay blinked back a tear after she said that. Bethany now burned with shame, thinking of the moment that passed between them. She didn't know why she said that to him. The words just poured out of her like she was in a movie and someone behind the scenes fed her the lines. Bethany felt the truth of those words deep down, and at the same time didn't feel them at all. Even so, the walls seemed to press them closer after she spoke. It may have been such an emotional moment because of the way the late sun was slanting from the kitchen door, the temporary absence of cars rolling down the street. Somehow, the world held its breath, and they were bound up in twilight. But back to the fart. When Jay stepped into the shower, Bethany was mortified with anticipatory embarrassment. He'd smell her stink for sure. Not knowing what to do, she jumped out, dried off, grabbed her clothes, and hurled out the door. All this without a word. Who was this woman with her wet, uncombed hair, shirt buttoned askew, shoes flattened at the heel, coursing down S Street? Where was she going? She had no idea. All she knew was that she needed to escape from the humiliation of her flatulence. Now she was doubly in a fix. Bethany had to own up to the fart, and or explain why she flew out of the house. Could she deny the fart and say she needed an emergency tampon? Could she say she suddenly felt ill? Could she say his shower stall stunk so badly from an unknown effluvial source that she became desperate for fresh air? Here's what she did. After about 15 minutes, Bethany returned to Jay's house with a pack of condoms. He was a little confused, but in the end, very happy. There was no mention of any bad smells. They found their way back into the cosy summer evening, early June, when the long stretch of late daylight is a marvel to be burned up during a slow fuck. Jay insisted on full nudity in bed after lovemaking, something that Bethany detested. She always felt cold and unmoored when she was naked in bed, like wearing a t-shirt at least. And though she complied with the rule, Jay had a second edict that confounded her further: no cuddling during sleep. It would have driven her crazy if she thought the relationship didn't have a built-in expiration date. Were she to dare make an excuse for her two-timing heartlessness, Bethany would point to the fact that her mother was dying during this time. It would prove to be a slow, painful passing, one that required nearby distractions. She had been appointed the main caregiver, interpreter of medical terms, driver and late-night companion. Her mother was only 67, and the picture of health before cancer clawed into her bones. There is something about the nearness of death that makes you want to swing on chandeliers. Because she could not face the loss head-on, Bethany faked left and right in the arms of a man who said in a thousand different unspoken ways that without her, life was almost unbearable. That confession somehow made Bethany's life bearable. She doesn't remember or chooses not to remember what happened to Jay and her near the end. It was more involved than it had to be. Again, her fault for agreeing to visit his hometown. His mother and estranged father, and then on the way back, engaged in fully clothed, keep-your-eyes-on-the-road sex. Wrong. There followed an eerie silence after they stopped seeing each other. One day, after 2 months of no contact, she called his office and was told by his secretary that Jay wasn't there, just stepped out, was in a meeting. The woman's sweet voice belied another story. Though it wasn't like her, Bethany insisted on the truth. Bethany broke her down until the secretary admitted finally, Jay's in the hospital with a brain tumour, having brain surgery tomorrow. What was Bethany to do with this information? Obtain more until she knew everything? What hospital? What time? Who's the doctor? What kind of tumour? Is it terminal? How's he doing? It turned out the tumour was benign. A meningioma. But Bethany deduced from the late night research that it must be an olfactory groove meningioma. A subtype that takes away one's sense of smell. That's why Jay never mentioned the fart. She was never in jeopardy after all. There's a joke that goes something like this. A man complains about how much his hand hurts because his wife squeezed it too hard during the labour of childbirth. I'm like that man, Bethany now admits to herself, or more accurately, I was like that man. She assesses her past transgressions with perspective from the safe perch of a happy life. She covets her happy life like a child with a popsicle too big for its mouth. She is pleased that Jay seemed to have had a good life after her, at least to the extent that happiness is evidence on Google. Psychotherapy has helped Bethany to understand what motivated her to slice through Jay's life like a scalpel, what kept her from staying out of his shower, his bed, his life, his mother's home, all of the places she did not belong. Perhaps it was because she spent so much time as a spectator of disease, and a witness to loss, addiction, and trauma. Years before all this, that for once she wanted to live according to her own selfish terms. The rollercoaster thrill of one-way love substituted for the attention she craved, but never received as a child. There were a million reasons if one wanted to drill deeply. Bethany desperately wanted in on Jay's brain surgery. She wanted to become involved, perhaps even necessary to the whole ordeal. She wanted to see Jay in his miserable post-operative state, to let him know that she still cared about him as a friend, even though she proved to be an unstable bitch of a girlfriend, if he could ever even call her that. It just so happened that her mother was getting her weekly, useless chemotherapy at the same hospital where Jay had his surgery. This was another Jenga piece to which Bethany assigned powerful import. As usual, Bethany escorted her mother and sat with her as the IV poison dripped into her bloodstream. Afterwards, she found her way into Jay's room, hoping to see something or say something or do something that would change all the inevitable outcomes of their lives. Jay was barely conscious, but well enough to recognise her. His head was wrapped in bandages like a continental soldier, his blue eyes lit upon her. His mother set her stern and protective gaze upon Bethany. Bethany's own mother was somewhere in the room as well, but the room was dim because the light would hurt Jay's eyes. It was so much like a dream that sometimes Bethany recalls it as one. It was so pushy and wrong and violent to have trespassed upon that tragic tableau that Bethany doesn't tell her psychiatrist about it, even after all those sessions. Because his wife squeezed it so hard during childbirth his hand hurts, and he complains about the pain in his hand. Perspective bludgeons Bethany with a severe rebuke of her selfishness on that day. It is with no ego that she must admit that Jay loved her, and she was far too casual with his feelings. She regrets almost everything that she allowed to happen. Why is it so easy to be cruel when we know we are in control? Months later, she visited him in his quiet federal-style apartment within the same quiet kitchen where she lied about her fart. He was feeling much better, except for a small complaint. "What's that?" she asked. For no reason, at unexpected times, I'm become labile. It was a word she was not yet familiar with. Labile means unstable. In this context, he meant emotionally. I cry easily, he explained.
Other People's Flowers was produced by Hugo Gibson, Chris Kamonvutitam, and Hamish Adam Cairns. If you'd like to have your work featured on the show, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. Thank you for listening.